So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to Rivulubay.
Ladies, ladies, stop the fighting. If you're going to fight, you've got one of two choices. Be like all the rest of the chicks and fight over the heartbreak kid, or be like the dudes and, well, fight Ahmed because he's my back door. I got news for you, boys. You better stick together, because if you don't, me and Ahmed will, and we will survive. Wild card match, wild night. Coat. What a wild two.
Back to ringside we go. The wild card match coming at you next.
All right. Thank you very much, Todd Pettengill. It is wild. No doubt about it.
Well, a most unique, you might say, WWF president thus far. He's done some pretty wild things.
I mean, I'm glad the match is happening. This is going to be wild. That's why they call it a wild card. But you got to wonder what Monsoon was thinking when he put these eight men together.
One wild night.
Welcome to Review Away. I'm John Pollock, joined by Wei Ting. Today's edition of Review Away is brought to you by our proud sponsor, Tim Hortons, who has brought me a large coffee with a milk and sugar.
And
you got the festive cup.
Yes.
The fuck? Why do I just get the normal 50th anniversary cup?
They probably just ran out of cups.
But you went after me.
Okay, well, I don't know, man.
What are you drinking?
I'm drinking an Earl Grey tea, and this thing took me forever to get. I don't know what it is, but if you're ever in the Liberty Village area in downtown Toronto, stay away from the East Liberty Street Tim Hortons, because they must have some outreach program where they hire just the stupidest people
wow.
in the world to do their jobs. And, you know, I'm all for, like, hiring
outreach.
Programs. I'm all for outreach, exactly. I don't know if, any type of customer relations, anything where you have to interact with the customer, I don't know if that's the job you necessarily put certain people in, because I mean, if you thought my ordering of a burger with our friends Braden and Damien last week was
an ordeal. Oh, boy, this was like good 5 minutes it took you to order a burger.
And it wasn't me. It wasn't my fault, was it?
What happened? I just saw a long interaction here, way longer than a simple order at a fast food chain.
I've just had some bad luck with with ordering food lately, where I feel like I'm explaining myself pretty clearly, but for whatever reason, I mean, I wanted, very simple, I wanted a tea with two sugars and two lactose-free milks.
You're doing a bit of reaching.
The stumbling block. They offer lactose-free milk. They always have. This particular location. They offer soy. They offer lactose-free milk. I'm lactose intolerant, and so I'll gladly take that option. So I made it very clear. I want two lactose-free milks. And then she seemed to have never heard of it. She thought I meant soy. I said, no, not soy. Lactose-free milk. She had to call her manager over to see what I was talking about. Clearly, English wasn't her first language. I don't know what language she did speak. I could have tried to speak the other language, but I don't know if I even know how to say lactose-free milk.
So part of it's on you, not being well-versed in multiple languages.
I partly blame myself because midway through I changed my teas. I wanted a Earl Grey instead.
Oh, dear. What did you originally want?
I asked for a green tea instead before. But then I thought, like, wow, I would put, like, shit in a green tea.
Is there a massive change in taste if they had served you a green tea instead of an Earl Grey
tea?
Would you have noticed?
It's just kind of unusual, I guess, to put, like, milk and stuff.
I never put milk in a green tea.
Yeah, I like my green teas plain. But anyway, it took me forever, and thus we're starting a little later. So sorry about that.
Well, they've been waiting.
Who has?
People waiting to download the show. We were on their time schedule. So thanks for joining us. Albeit a late
one. No problem.
You want to know a very bizarre story I had on Sunday? I got into an elevator. And I'm not one that likes to talk in the elevator. I find it very weird that people tend to have no filters in an elevator, yet they assume that they're alone. So I'm in the elevator by myself, and this woman walks in on her phone. and I am not exaggerating any of this, that her phone conversation consists of, so I asked Kathy, is Brandy pregnant? And Kathy just said, well, you didn't hear it from me. And I'm just going back to her saying, well, is she going to keep it? Because that would be the worst decision of her life, considering the two hate each other. And now they're going to have a child. Oh. And then got off at the next floor.
Okay.
I couldn't believe, this felt like this was out of a comedy sketch, that this portion of the phone call was reserved for the time I will be in an elevator with a stranger and just let them in on this woman who has a life-altering decision to make about having a child with a man she reportedly hates.
Well, but do you know who they're talking about?
Not a clue.
So then who cares?
It's just very bizarre.
Why?
I don't anticipate that you would get onto a elevator talking about a child.
Most elevators I wouldn't get reception in, so I don't know if I would do any talking.
You know, taxi cab confessionals? Why isn't there an elevator version?
Because they'd be really short.
Yes, but you could... Look what I just got.
I think that's a rarity, though. I mean,
you would have all day's footage in an elevator. Do you know how much stuff probably gets disseminated inside of an elevator?
You can. I mean, I think it would just be... You wouldn't get the depth of conversation that you would get in a taxi cab.
Right. Might make it... Maybe this would be more a series for, like, someone's like Vine account.
Instagram, yeah. Sure. Great. That's a great idea for an Instagram or a Vine, if you could get on that. But, I mean, you're there with a bunch of strangers who you'll probably never see in a very long time, you know? So who cares?
You know what I also want to start?
It's like the bathroom conversations. The worst, I think, is when, like, you're in a stall.
Oh, and the guy next to you wants to drum up a conversation?
That never happens to me.
It happens to me.
Okay, well, that's weird. But
it doesn't happen to me often. I was once recognized in a bathroom.
Oh, like while you're using the... Before you use the bathroom or after?
During.
That's weird. Like, what are you talking about? Like number one or two?
Urinal.
Oh, okay. I'm talking about both. But...
No, just at the urinal.
Well, that's not that bad. But yeah, it's a little weird. I'd wait until you're done.
I remember once going to see Dumb and Dumber when I was like 11 years old at a movie theater. And I was laughing so much from the movie. And I went to the washroom and I'm like still like giggling and laughing. And I had this paranoia that I couldn't stop laughing. And I thought someone would think I'm laughing at them or something in the bathroom.
Oh.
It could be a very awkward moment.
Yeah, like if you were to like look down at the dude while you're standing next to
him. Then you start laughing.
Yeah. Interesting. Sometimes like the worst is when you're in a stall and you hear like in the next stall a dude on his cell phone, like having an actual, like a business meeting while he's like taking a shit.
Yeah, and it's never a hands-free device either. It's like fully one hand up to the ear while the other's down south.
Well, you know how many, like, come on. Like, I think a lot of us use cell phones inside the bathroom now. You know how much, like...
Oh, I always go on my phone, but I'm never having a phone call.
Right, yeah, that's worse. But I'm just saying, if you're talking about...
I text you all the time.
Great, thanks. Good to know. But I'm just saying, if you're worried about contamination on our phones, I'm sure there's feces all over everybody's phones.
You know what the grossest thing is, and I only thought of this recently, is that what do you do when you finish doing your business at the bathroom? What is a common occurrence as soon as you're done?
You tell me. I don't know.
Do you not wash your hands?
Of course. No. Well, that's not what I do immediately after. There's a whole process of things
yes,
I do
yes,
after.
But once you get through all the,
okay.
measures, you go and you clean your hands, right?
Yeah.
Because it's gross not to.
Yeah, of course not.
But what do you touch every single time when you finish?
The tap?
Wrong. That you are wearing.
Oh, your pants.
Your belt.
Okay, yeah. Among other things.
And when was the last time you washed your belt?
Oh, good point, John. I've never washed my belt.
Do you know how much shit, and I'm not even exaggerating, has probably made its way onto your belt? Our belts must be absolutely filthy, dude. You don't clean those. You don't wash belts.
You don't wash
belts. Just hang them up. Dude, I've been wearing this belt. I've had the same belt for probably 10 years. 10 years of shit on my belt.
Oh, man. You should do something about that.
Do you know how much garbage is probably coming off your belt right now?
Yeah, I know. I'm just wearing a shit belt right now. It's just a belt.
It's so disgusting. And it, like, dawned on me just 2 weeks ago as I'm thinking about this. Like, you always touch your belt right after, before you wash your hands, and your belt just sits there.
You're so right, because everything else goes into the wash. Your shirt, you know, your underwear, your pants, but your belt stays out of the laundry, unless there's something people are doing that I don't know. Do you throw your belt, and can you throw your belt in the washing machine?
I don't know. I guess it would depend on, like, the make, the leather, what kind of material your belt is made out of. Maybe everyone should be using that rope.
Ropes, yeah.
Those hillbillies, they got it right, man.
Yeah, you just wash that.
Yeah.
Well, you've really changed my mind about belts.
This is the stuff I think about.
Yeah.
I'm concerned about.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what to do about that. I don't know what a solution would be.
Well, this particular show featured two men vying for a belt.
Okay. Oh, we'll take that, sure.
Diesel and Shawn Michaels. Diesel and Bret Hart.
Yeah.
Bret Hart. This is interesting because this is one of Diesel's two good matches in his career. So let's get into that.
What would you say the other was?
His final match in the company, or at least final pay-per-view match in the company, was Shawn Michaels.
Yeah.
So his two best matches of his career with Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels, I think most would agree. Clearly, I think some credit deserved to the opponents of one Kevin Nash.
Yep.
This was a fun show to go back and watch from the U.S. Air Arena in Landover, Maryland. We had a very heavy U.S. feel to this show. It was a very patriotic kind of a show, just being in the shadows of the White House. And it took place Sunday, November the 19th. Of 1995, this exact date.
Oh, wow.
19 weird. Years ago.
Well, weird. Wow. It
it's feels Wednesday, like, November 19th.
Feels like we're only a few days away, but okay.
No, it's the 19th. This was a show. I actually remember this. I remember being 11 years old.
Me too.
At this show, and my mom took me to the Santa Claus parade that day.
Oh.
And I remember thinking that the Survivor Series was that night, and this was during my scramble vision phase, where I came home to turn on the Survivor Series.
Yeah, just flick the switch
and listen to it, like it was on the radio.
You didn't even get to watch it.
No, I had to listen. This was my. I did not have pay per view.
You listened to it,
dude. I did that for years.
Wow. Okay.
And I thought I was so smart because I never had to spend $30. Didn't have to go hook up pay per view, but man, did I feel like, God damn it, I should be able to watch this.
No. Yeah. Did you ever inquire about black boxes?
I didn't have a few of my friends had black boxes, and I would always ask them, like, how can I get one of these? Can you get me one?
Yeah.
And it was always like, it was like I was asking around for heroin.
Pretty much,
it's just like, you know, it's hard to come by, and it's expensive, and it's illegal.
Yeah, we got one in our house, and that's how I was able to.
I was still scared to have a black box because of the illegal nature to it. I had a heavy conscience when I was a kid. Like, even the idea of splitting my cable. I was like, oh, my God, what if someone finds out? What if the cable company finds out we split our cable?
Yeah, you could go to jail.
I thought, man, what a shitty way to go to prison.
Yeah.
Like, what are you in for? It's like, I got cable for half price.
And then what happened? You became a criminal.
I guess so.
You started killing Tamagotchis and stealing chocolate bars. When did that change?
Stealing chocolate bars? I was not.
You shoplifted chocolate bars.
Oh, I did. I did at times shoplift chocolate bars as a child.
So where did the change occur?
I don't know. I had a real...
When did you become such a bad ass?
I don't know, eh? I guess I found religion at some point in my life and really changed everything around.
Okay. We had a black box, and it was weird because...
So did you watch this show?
Oh, I watched the show live. I have very vivid memories.
Man, so you watched this, and I hadn't.
Yeah, I listened. And, but the thing about the black box was, you know, the way it was explained to us was like, oh, yeah, now, now, you know, your baby brother, which was me, like, oh, now your little brother can watch all these cartoons, all these cartoon movies. And then meanwhile, like, I mean, I would watch the TV by myself. And then, like, I would go and watch the cartoon movies. But they also showed porn at that time.
Oh, dear.
So not only did I get all this, you know, Disney, all these Disney movies, I could probably got Hook. I got... I got
you probably got a Hook hookers. Parody.
Yeah, at night too. So you're probably better off without it. It made for some awkward moments at my house.
Oh man,
yeah.
I'm trying to think of what would be a Peter Pan porn parody.
Hookers, obviously.
Hookers. Yeah, that's pretty good. To the point. So here you are, 11 years old. You've got your Disney movies, WWF wrestling, and porn.
And a ton of porn.
What more could you have wanted?
No, I had a pretty great childhood, man. I have to say. Yeah.
Do you remember any of these porn titles or just your initial reaction?
I don't know the titles. I just...
That was always my favorite part of, you know, was the titles. I was like, man, I honestly believe that, you know, if all else fails in life, I would love to just come up with porn parody titles.
I think you'd be great at that job.
I think I get bored of it pretty quick, but I would love it.
Okay, let's think of what was number one at the box office this week?
You know? Dumb and Dumber 2, actually, was this past weekend. $38 million.
Can you come up with a porn parody?
Dumb and Cummer.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, yeah. Hire this
Fox Catcher. Cock Snatcher? I don't know. No, that one doesn't work as well. Cock Snatcher.
You just said that.
No, I said Cock Snatcher. Cock
Snatcher?
Oh, Jesus. God, Jesus Christ.
We need a meeting. We need a group meeting.
Wednesday morning.
somebody hire this.
I wonder what was in this Tim Hortons coffee. Maybe you didn't get Earl Grey or green tea.
Maybe I didn't get non-lactose. Maybe the non-lactose was like laced with something else.
Oh boy.
All right, let's get to it.
Show started off with a cold open featuring the reintroduction of Mr. Perfect, who was back in the company.
Oh, okay.
For those that remember, WrestleMania 10, Mr. Perfect returned as the guest referee, turning on Lex Luger and causing Yokozuna to win that match. And then Hennig was scheduled for a big run with Luger, but would shortly disappear after that, nursing his back injury, and came back here at this pay-per-view and would start calling shows, working as a color commentator. And then, as you recall, this would eventually turn into a little program with Triple H. And then, a year after this, Hennig would disappear once again. Hmm. He didn't seem to be the most, I guess, dependable employee at this particular time, between injuries and eventually ending up in WCW in 97.
And I think it's very unfortunate because, you know, physically he's still, I mean, injuries aside, he still seemed to be, he seemed to be young and seemed to be destined for much greater things than he actually went on to achieve at this time.
So he comes out. The opening is built around tonight's main event, which is the third match between Diesel and Bret Hart. The first two matches had been very indecisive. Tonight, Diesel was defending the title against Bret, and Bret Hart at his finest with some of the lines he had. And he really enjoyed this one. Diesel... The truck stops here.
Oh, nice.
Boy.
I get it.
A determined Bret Hart who would have analogies to Wayne Gretzky on this show, comparing himself to a Timex watch. Bret in full force on this show.
I love it. I think it's great. I mean, I should say I'm very nostalgic for this era because, you know...
And this is not a time period that is fondly remembered.
Not at all, but I think just due to our age, probably, you know, being...
There was some great talent on this show. And
in hindsight, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe not at the time, not really appreciated, but...
Yeah, I think the talent wasn't so much as focused upon at this time in the WWF as the over-the-top characters were. Like, this was really them at their... cartooniest of generations, at least over the past 25 years.
And therefore, I think it makes these shows even that much more fun to look back at because, oh, man, here's, you know, Kane as a dentist or...
Yeah, and so many guys that would be repackaged going into the Attitude Era, this being their pre-Attitude Era characters, or, like the dentist.
Or Shane Douglas.
Keeping it real Fatu.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, not only that, but because, you know, probably you and I share the experience of being Canadian while, you know, your top babyface, or one of your top babyfaces at the time, was also a Canadian. So it was it was a fun time to watch the stuff as a kid.
The show started off with a traditional Survivor Series elimination match. We had the underdogs, Marty Jannetty, Bob Holly, Hakushi, and Barry Horowitz.
What a terrible group to be in, and what a terrible group to be named after, you know?
The underdogs.
Group of, just call them the losers.
Basically, Barry Horowitz's gimmick for years and years until they finally decided, well, we're going to do a program with Barry Horowitz and Skip. Mm-hmm. One of our holdovers from last week's review, Chris Candido.
A number of them, actually.
A number, so. You're right.
Tammy Lynn Fitch.
you're right.
Yeah.
Who played a bitch, but wasn't named bitch on this show. This was actually the day after the 1995 November to Remember.
And we reviewed that last week?
No, that was one we passed over in favor of the 1998 version. A giant mistake on our part.
So confused.
The underdogs were taking on... Did these guys even have a team name? I didn't hear it.
I didn't catch it.
Okay, it was the team consisting of Skip, Rad Radford. This is their answer to... the big grunge uprising. Rad Radford.
Yeah, what's a cool sounding name, you know?
Oh, he's rad. wait, that's Rad Radford. Rad Radford. Goddamn.
Yeah, how do we make him twice?
Rad Radford.
How do we make him twice as rad?
Holy shit.
It'd be like
Cool Coolio.
Yeah. Or it would be John Johnson.
Rap Rapperton.
Yeah, what an unfortunate name. This was Louis Spicoli.
Yes, Louis Spicoli, Tom Pritchard, and the 1-2-3 Kid.
And didn't Tom Pritchard actually join the Body Donnas?
He would, the very next month, would be transformed into Zip.
Okay. And Rad Radford here was supposed to be a Body Donna in training.
Yes, so the former Madonna's boyfriend.
Okay.
Would have been a way better name than Rad Radford. Pretty shitty names, actually, in both AAA and WWF.
Yeah. But how does a guy go from being a grunge rocker to an athlete, I suppose.
This is how.
I guess Robin Black would be an example.
I guess he
just had enough of the rock lifestyle.
Yes.
Okay.
The 1-2-3 Kid had just turned heel at this point in time, desperately in need of a new name if you were going to turn heel. The 1-2-3 Kid. Like a lot of terrible names at this point.
1-2-3 Man.
The 1-2-3 Man. Kid is now managed by Ted DiBiase after his turn. We also had Sonny in the heel corner. And 1-2-3 Kid was taking the place of the injured Jean-Pierre Lafitte, the pirate.
Yeah.
This is
Brawl for All fighter. Brawl for All alumni.
Razor Ramon is being held back by officials at the start of the match. He's trying to go after the 1-2-3 Kid. And this was after Kid had assisted Sid to defeat Razor Ramon on Raw. Vince explains how the Kid had hinted on an AOL chat this week that he might appear on this team. So this was a last-minute change, and America Online was the Twitter of 1995. There was quite the push here for America Online at the time.
They were on top of that.
They were well ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
I thought a very hot crowd at the start here for what was essentially just an undercard match. We saw Pritchard accidentally knock Kid off the apron. Bob Holly, hit a Hurricane Rana to Rad Radford, and described by Mr. Perfect as a good wrestling maneuver as he puts the pedal to the metal. And then Hakushi is tagged in, identified by Vince McMahon as a modern-day kamikaze.
Yes.
He's a Japanese kamikaze.
He will go out
Pearl Harbor.
He will commit suicide to pin this man in a wrestling match.
Lots of heat on the 1-2-3 Kid as he hit his splash off the top to Hakushi. There were actually chants of Barry during this match for Horowitz. Pritchard misses a moonsault to Holly. Holly then hits a crossbody off the top, eliminating Pritchard. And then Skip immediately comes from behind and schoolboys Holly to eliminate him. Skip hits a top rope Frankensteiner to a Hakushi, and then does the flare flop as he's going to his corner for the tag.
That was interesting. And then Vince explained that he had actually hit his own head in delivering the Hurricane Rana.
Yeah, an actual explanation of a man having a concussion.
And I bought it. Mid-match. I've never seen that, but yeah, it works.
Hakushi comes in, fires up on the kid, gets a great reaction, hits a top rope shoulder tackle.
How much time do you think it takes him to get ready for a match with all the writing all those characters on his body?
I always imagine that you would think they have some kind of
print.
Yeah, like that you can just like
stencil?
A stencil.
Perhaps
that would save time. Would you think? Like Goldust, they've shown footage where it's like he just applies it, and my God, must that take just forever?
He's probably gotten really fast at it now.
I guess, it's like your head you're covering.
But
know?
With Hakushi, he would need somebody to do it for him. And I wonder how many people would have great Japanese calligraphy on staff at all.
Probably
times.
Not Vince.
Probably not Vince. But you're right, a stencil would probably be way faster.
Where are we then? Hakushi, he hits that top rope shoulder tackle. Razor Ramon, they show in the back, just losing his mind, tossing a monitor in the back, just watching the 1-2-3 kids succeeding. Radford then pins Hakushi after a kick to the back of the head after that 1-2-3 kid hit him with. They get the heat on Horowitz. Radford starts doing push-ups for Skip, and he's showing off. And this allows Horowitz to cradle Radford and eliminate Radford. Kid then attacks Horowitz from behind after the tag, eliminates him. It's down to 2-on-1 with Jannetty here, hitting a Famouser to Skip. Then climbs up to the top rope.
It's the rocker dropper.
The rocker dropper at this time. And Sonny shakes the ropes. Skip climbs up, but Jannetty turns it into a powerbomb off the top.
Yeah, this was...
This was like not what you associate with the WWF style of 1995.
Not at all. This was like New Japan, you know, light heavyweight type of stuff, man.
Yeah. This was very impressive here. I mean, Marty Jannetty, like a professional screw-up, but... when he was at his peak, this guy was a tremendous performer and just created every stumbling block imaginable in his career. Skip climbs up. Kid gets tagged in, hits a top rope leg drop for a two count, then attempts this somersault leg drop off the top.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
These guys are doing some
This was
things,
incredible. Like, I was blown away at some of the spots in this match. Sid comes down to ringside. Jannetty hits another rocker dropper. Foot gets on the rope. DiBiase then distracts the referee, allowing Sid to snap Jannetty's neck on the top. And Kid gets the pin. Kind of a shitty anticlimactic finish, but a heel victory for the 1-2-3 Kid, who was the guy you had the most focus in this match. 19 minutes, 9 seconds. Very strong opener.
I thought so, too. Definitely delivered more than I think anybody expected. You know, Jannetty, I thought, looked tremendous. It was great to see somebody like Sean Waltman here, you know, who I think we always, anytime we go back and watch one of his matches, he always impresses. He's always very good in the ring. But at this time, I thought he was even more physical and more risk-taking than he was in later parts of his career. So he looked great, as did Chris Candido and Hakushi. I thought it was just a fun match with, you know, all around good wrestling that was a good representation of what you can achieve in a Survivor Series style match.
I also like the pacing, where it wasn't the idea, we're going to do a million of these spots. It was like there were 3 to 4 big, big spots. They were all impactful, I thought, and they all registered with you.
Mm-hmm.
And just a very impressive opener. Doc Hendricks, the unsung hero of the 1995 Survivor Series, his role at this time was to hawk merchandise, beginning with the Survivor Series t-shirt, that is available for $16.
They cut a lot of this out of the network.
Oh, man. Yeah. Did they cut out the denim jacket plug?
I switched to your feed.
Oh, boy.
For that, so I did catch that.
Classic.
I wish I had one.
Still to come, folks, the real main event of the Survivor Series. Then we had another interesting Survivor Series elimination match. This featured both women from the WWF at the time, as well as All Japan Women, who, this interestingly enough, All Japan Women had working agreements at the time with both WWF and WCW at this time. And this was 4 weeks before Alundra Blaze would show up on Nitro as Medusa, dropping the title into the garbage can. Her contract would expire just a few weeks after this show. So this was her last pay-per-view appearance.
So how would they switch talent, All Japan Women, how would they switch talent between WCW and WWE?
Well, it wasn't like it was, you know, talent could go to both. They had certain talent that, like, Akira Hokuto was going to work at
with WCW at the time, and they just had these open lines of communication where certain talent was able to go to the WWF, others were going with WCW, but not too often that you would see, you know, working agreements between two major organizations, essentially, with the middle person.
And do you know how the booking would work?
I'm not sure. I think it was largely dependent upon just building, you know, where the title was going to be. They would send a Lundra over to Japan, then they'd bring back some of the talent here for this pay-per-view.
But I mean, like, would say the WWE determine who wins matches, or would it be a combination of...
I don't know for sure. I would imagine on the WWF pay-per-view, especially in something like this, you know, Aja Kong was clearly a big focus of this match because they were planning to build to Alundra Blaze and Aja Kong at the Royal Rumble. That was their target. Right. So I'm sure both were on the same page of building to this title match. So we had Alundra Blaze, the women's champion at the time, with Kyoko Inoue, Saki Hasegawa, and Chaparita Asari taking on Bertha Faye, Aja Kong, Lioness Asuka, and Tomoko Watanabe. And, like, this wasn't even... subliminal. Vince flat out said, JR, call the match.
Oh, yeah.
And reminded him midway through the match, all right, get back to calling it. Like, Vince was not even going to dip his toe into this one.
I can't pronounce this shit.
You know, a lot of people enjoy Kurt Hennig on color commentary. I didn't think he was that great on this show. And this particular match, it ranged from lazy to offensive.
Whatever happened to the All-American lady?
Beg your pardon?
Whatever happened to the All-American lady, I said?
Alundra Blaze or Bertha Faye, take your pick.
These women should be at home making their own man something to eat.
Oh, absolutely. There are points where he would say things like, these women should be back in the kitchen making this sandwich.
Making their man some food.
And obviously, I get it, he's playing a heel, but even as a heel, you wouldn't be able to get away with that today.
It felt very lazy, to be honest.
Like, yeah, sure. No real preparation done, but, you know.
Jim Ross, on the other hand, digging up, you know, information like who the national spokeswoman of Orange Juice is.
Yeah, Ross clearly was told beforehand. I mean, either that or he clearly realized none of these other two guys will be doing any type of research about these women, so he took it upon himself to pretty much play the Mike Tenay role.
Yeah, and not even, we didn't even choose this on purpose, but kind of coincides with, you know, kind of the style we're going to hear Jim Ross probably calling for New Japan. Everyone assumes it's going to be the, you know, Attitude Era, over-the-top Jim Ross. It's like, I'm much more expecting a much more leveled Jim Ross, much like when he called Mid-South, WCW. And I think this is kind of a bit of a look at kind of the style you might hear from Jim Ross at the New Japan show. Anyway... Vince just asks JR, what do you know about these Japanese superstars? As Ross just starts going down background information on all of them.
All right, Jim Ross, go ahead, start the call.
Chaparita Asari starting it out here.
First big spot was from Asari, who hit the Sky Twister Press to Lioness Asuka, basically AJ Styles' spiral tap. Mm-hmm. Looked really good.
Like at 95, man.
I know.
You know?
That's a show. That's something, an era we haven't really gone back to, the All Japan Women mid-90s.
Man, I'd love to do one of those shows.
I just found, actually, I was cleaning out my all my tapes, and I found a DVD of an All Japan Women's card from the early 90s.
Right.
We should totally review one, because I could... not get tired of this at all.
Because, like, I mean, you just see the level of work from the women in this match, and they're just leaps and bounds, not only above, you know, obviously the women in North America. But with that said, I thought Alundra Blaze did very well here, too. But,
oh, hung with them well.
But nowhere near the level of what these women looked at. I mean, and not just women, but, like, these women worked better than a lot of the men on the roster.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, at a time when, you know, these women were on par with all of their male counterparts.
Absolutely.
At this time, from that era of like 93 through 96, absolutely. Watanabe went for a moonsault off the top, but no one was there, and just lands on her chest. Then we saw these double underhook suplexes by Hasegawa.
Rolling.
Yeah, like almost like you know,
Eddie Guerrero.
Exactly, kind of, but with double underhook suplexes. Yeah. I have not seen that since.
No, and it looked great. It looked tremendous.
Aja Kong is identified by Vince as the big one, as she is tagged in. Perfect just lost here. And this is where Vince just instructs, during a moment of silence, all right, JR, continue with the call. Kong hits this overhead suplex, eliminating Hasegawa, and then hits a splash off the turnbuckle, eliminating Asari, just before JR gets to note of Asari's role, the national spokesperson for Orange Juice in Japan. You need a face on Orange Juice.
Sure, yeah. Don't we have that Here?
Orange juice. Back in 95, the spokesperson for OJ was Simpson.
Yes.
Inoue comes in, goes for a sunset flip. Kong just sits down, eliminating her. So it's now down to a 3-on-1 with Kong, Bertha Fey, and Watanabe against Alundra Blaze. There was this confusion as there was a snap suplex by Blaze to Watanabe, who got her shoulder up, and they were very confused if it was a pinfall or not. And Blaze, it looked like, just kind of improvised here with a pile driver eliminating Watanabe. So Kong and Fey then accidentally collide. Fey gets eliminated with a bridging German from Blaze. Perfect notes that this is the first time the women have been part of the Survivor Series, which Ross quickly corrects him with, was not the case, mm-hmm. bringing up the 1987 show. There's a standing moonsault for a 2-count by Blaze, and then Kong just beats her down with a pair of avalanches and then a spinning backfist. I love this as a finish. And gets the win, 10 minutes, 2 seconds. The traditional Japanese music signifies the win for Aja Kong. And they really built up this eventual collision between these two for the title, which was the plan for the next year's Rumble, but Blaze's contract would expire December 13th, and as history shows, was not renewed, and the WWF wasn't planning to renew it. They chose not to continue with this women's division, and then Blaze showed up on Nitro.
We, you know, a couple weeks back, it feels like, we reviewed an Alundra Blaze. What was the other Japanese match? She fought somebody else. Was it Bull Nakano?
Oh, right.
We did one of those matches. And I think, you know, we remarked then about how this was sort of an era of women's wrestling in the WWF that's really never talked about. And I'm glad we got to review another one of these matches, because this was certainly one of the highlights of this show. You know, just to see the All Japan women work, they're just on a completely different level, working so much crisper than faster than most of the women and men on the roster. So I'd love to see more of just that.
It was the most diverse presentation of the women's division the WWF ever had. I mean, it's always been, even the most kind of the in-ring peak of the women 10 years ago, it was always just beautiful women presented. That's how they've always been presented. And these women were just presented as like these athletes.
Yeah.
And there was nothing about, you know, their...
No, there's, I mean, certainly with people like Bull Nakano and Aja Kong, there's a certain theatric...
You had like these monster heels, which you never see in the company. It's very rare. Like outside of a Luna Vachon, certainly the exception. Backstage, we have Ramon and the 1-2-3 Kid on the superstar line. And then, I don't know what the fascination was, but this was like multiple times they went to this well with the Bill Clinton impersonator. Like, this was so lame. And they went back to this.
This was so lame, but so awesome.
So Todd Pettengill is interviewing the fake Bill Clinton, who, of course, was the president at the time, confuses Bam Bam Bigelow with a member of the Flintstones, and Pettengill takes a cheap shot at his administration for being out of touch. Then the pyro for Bam Bam Bigelow goes off, and the security team all panic and take Bill Clinton down. And this provided like a backdrop for Vince to get in like these snarky comments, because there was a government shutdown at this point in 1995, and taking like these cheap shots at the Democrats.
Yeah, it's so corny, but I just love the idea that everybody's playing along. Like, Todd Pettengill actually thinks this is the real president, and Vince thinks this is the actual president.
Oh, believe me, 11-year-old John Pollock was very confused.
Oh,
I couldn't see this.
What do you think this, you know, this Bill Clinton impersonator is doing now?
Wait, that's why we have a tool that Bill Clinton's vice president invented called the Internet.
Okay.
Bill Clinton.
There's no way you'd be able to figure out.
I bet you I could. Bill Clinton impersonator, WWF. There's only one.
What's his name?
We're going to find out. They just had his name there. Tim. Tim Waters.
Tim, no way. Oh, I mean, there are multiple Bill Clinton impersonators.
Oh, sorry, I thought this was the same one.
This might not be him.
Oh, dude, it's him.
Oh, it is.
That's 100%
okay.
Him.
What is he doing now?
Okay, Tim Waters is the best Bill Clinton impersonator in political comedy. He's been on he's gotten quite a lot of work.
I suppose he's still doing this, but I imagine with far less bookings these days. Oh, he still looks all right. He looks a bit chubbier. He's there with the Barack Obama impersonator. You know, he'd be a good act at a discount. You know what I mean? Like, oh, shit, guys, we couldn't afford the Obama impersonator, but look what we got instead.
Bill Clinton. Tim Waters as MrPresident.com is where you can book this, man.
Oh, it's definitely him.
Yeah.
He plays saxophone. Call. Tim. Let's call him right now.
The presidential hotline. Dude, let's call him.
All right. Exclusive here.
Let's book him. Let's book him for WrestleMania, sure.
Presidential hotline.
Hello, my fellow Americans.
I wonder if the presidential hotline has a voicemail.
Maybe Monica will pick up.
Oh, boy. Maybe Tammy Lynn Sitch is still negotiating that cabinet position.
Yes.
Bill Barber, please leave a message at tone. I will return your call as soon as possible. Thank you so much for calling.
The mailbox is full and cannot accept any messages
bullshit.
At this time. Goodbye.
Well, that was definitely him.
Well, we wanted to book him. We wanted to pay him big money.
Maybe the Christmas party. We'll chat with the president.
Fuck. Okay, well, that was kind of exciting.
Tim Waters.
It would have been nice if we could have actually talked to him.
Yes, full voice. Maybe the bookings are just through the roof.
We could have advertised Bill Clinton on this podcast.
Well, Bill Clinton was on.
Yeah.
He was absolutely on.
His recording was.
Yeah. Well, that was fun. Way more entertaining than the actual appearance at the Survivor Series. We then got, where did we go? Bam Bam Bigelow and Goldust. Goldust had just debuted about a month or so prior to this against Bam Bam Bigelow, who... do you recall what we were discussing in regards to Bam Bam Bigelow last week about November to Remember?
Yeah, you were saying how he was about to leave for WCW.
Well, guess when his final WWF match took place?
Whoa.
This is it. This dude just leaves. This is his final match with the WWF.
And next we will do his final match with WCW, I guess.
Yeah, he was there till the end of WCW, the bitter end. But here was Bigelow. Interesting to note, here's a guy that headlined WrestleMania that year against Lawrence Taylor. And the idea was he was going to lose to Taylor, they'd turn him babyface, and he'd get a massive push. And here we were by the Survivor Series, and he was leaving.
Yeah.
So, not a great year for the Bammer.
No.
We got an insert promo from Goldust. This was prior to Marlena even being attached to him. He was just solo act coming out, quoted a Planet of the Apes movie. Is undefeated so far in the WWF, and Vince describes him as, quote, a little androgynous.
Hmm.
So, appealing to both sides. Ross also adds that he's been one of the hot topics on America Online. That's the version of trending.
Yeah. What would the user base have been of America Online at the time?
Oh, I have no idea.
Couldn't have been like, maybe 100,000? Could it have been more than...
Specifically so going to the WWF chat rooms and stuff like that, I wouldn't know.
Yeah,
it was before my time on
the
internet.
But, Goldust, I think at this point, was just so different, you know. And to this day, obviously, you know, I think one of the best characters that they've ever come up with, especially in a time when all the characters that were coming out of the WWF were such stereotypes.
Yeah, you were kind of numb to any kind of... characters.
I suppose this was too. Just another kind of a homosexual stereotype, but I think the look and the whole package was just really so unique. And especially if you've seen any of Dustin Runnels' work before this, to go from, you know, his WCW run to this, and just the amount of thought he seemed to have put into the character, everything from, you know, the promos to even just the posture, the way he would stand when he wasn't even wrestling. I thought it was just so unique, you know.
Goldust clotheslines the post on the floor when Bigelow gets out of the way, but doesn't affect his arm at all. Then clotheslines Bigelow over the top to the floor. Crowd very quiet for this match. Vince doing nothing here to put over Bigelow. In fact, the commentators are basically saying that, you know, Bigelow doesn't look that great in this match. Just kind of burying him on his way out here in favor of Goldust, who was the pushed act. Bigelow lifts up Goldust for an electric chair, makes his comeback, misses a splash in the corner, and Goldust just hits this awkward running bulldog, pinning him at 8:20. I thought this was a pretty weak match.
The finish really came out of nowhere, just a bulldog and a pin.
Yeah, it didn't seem anyone was into either of these guys. The commentary really didn't tell a great story of the match. I don't think Bigelow was really into this.
No.
It felt pretty flat on a show that really didn't have too many down points. Back to Bill Clinton. This time Bob Backlund has joined him. Won't shake Bill Clinton's hand. There's some terrible dialogue back and forth about Clinton wanting Backlund to run against him next year now that Colin Powell has bowed out of the race. Exciting stuff.
Mm.
Then we got the background of the Undertaker-Mabel feud, including Mabel breaking the Undertaker's orbital bone. They explained it in storyline as being a leg drop on Raw. It was actually this errant punch that Mabel delivered to him on a house show and legitimately broke his orbital bone, and this was the Undertaker's return after a month off television. So we had the Royals, Jerry Lawler, King Mabel, Triple H, and the man of the crowns, Isaac Yankem, DDS, against the Dark Side, team names that they must have been up for just nights on end coming up with. The Undertaker and three men that personify the Dark Side. Henry Godwin, the pig farmer. Yeah. Savio Vega, the dancing Puerto Rican. And keeping it real, Fatu in his least remembered gimmick, where he went from a head shrinker to a man on the street that just no way he's going to fake the funk any longer.
No.
He's keeping it real with his leather MC Hammer outdated look by 1995.
He's trying to make a difference by
wearing boots.
Yeah. I totally don't remember this incarnation of Fatu. And, man, if you think about it, the number of second chances and third chances and fourth chances this guy must have had to get over before he finally found something in Rikishi, it really is.
The gimmick that amazing. Worked actually put his health at its absolute lowest point, probably.
That tends to happen sometimes.
Fatu comes out. His jacket reads, "It's time to make a change." Surprised they weren't selling this on the WWF hotline.
You know, it's just not that cool. You know, like,
Would you ever wear something like with like, think of like those annoying motivational quotes you always see on Twitter. Imagine putting that on a jacket and wearing it.
Yeah, like, I mean, I get wanting to make a positive change and making a difference, but you have to kind of approach it from a different angle. This is just lame.
Best part of the entrance was Henry Godwin dancing to Savio Vega's theme as he entered the ring.
Mm-hmm.
All future Brawl for All contestants here.
Oh, right.
Godwin, Vega.
No, not Fatu.
Yeah, well, two of them. Vince McMahon, my God, did he sell The Undertaker's entrance as like Christ returning. It was just an epic call by Vince McMahon.
How about Mabel's entrance coming out on a platform carried by, four men?
This was the height of King Mabel coming off a SummerSlam main event.
Literally.
And winning the King of the Ring, yes. And this was the match where you just saw so many different characters that would be a key part of the Attitude Era.
Oh, yeah.
And under different gimmicks completely, whether it be Mabel, Hunter, Yankem, Godwin, who slightly changed, Fatu,
mm-hmm.
Even Savio Vega kind of transformed into the Los Boricuas leader.
Mm-hmm.
But all kind of guys that you'd see go through that transformation on the undercard.
Yeah.
And Hunter main event, and along with Kane.
It's amazing that four of these guys, at least all on the same team. Or sorry, three of the four men on the Royals are still employees today. You have Triple H, you have Kane, and you have Jerry Lawler.
Yes. An early Undertaker-Kane interaction here on the show. Godwin shouts in the air as Vince proclaims that he's calling the hogs.
Mm. What does that sound like?
I don't know.
Hog call?
He's just yelling into the air to reach the hogs. Hennig corrects Vince McMahon early on, who refers to Hunter Hearst Helmsley, and Hennig says he prefers to be called Triple H.
Oh, is that right?
Maybe the first time it's been coined. Lawler had the ugliest mullet in existence.
No, I'd give that to Bob Holly on this show.
I don't know. This Lawler one, it looked just terrible. Just hideously kept mullet. They worked over Fatu. Mabel missed a splash in the corner. Vega comes in, runs into a slam by Mabel. I thought Isaac Yankum, very mobile here for a big man, even hitting this drop kick to Vega coming off the ropes. Lawler, this was their way to just get digs in on him. Hits his patented maneuver, the pile driver, which Vega kicks out of. Then hits a second one that Vega just literally pops up from. No selling it, and just tags out. Just prostituting this pile driver. Every Memphis fan just cringing. Taker comes in to a massive reaction. No one wants to tag Lawler in. And Lawler hits a tombstone, pins Lawler, then hits a flying clothesline to Yankum, tombstones him for the elimination. Hunter just backs off to the floor. Godwin corners him, sends him back into the ring. And Taker hits him with a choke slam into the ring, pinning Hunter. And then Mabel comes in, delivers a belly-to-belly from behind, hits the leg drop, which Taker sits up from. Mabel just stumbles to the floor. Sir Mo distracts Undertaker as Mabel runs to the back, is counted out at 14:25, and the Royals, all of them survive, with the Undertaker eliminating everybody, and this would build to the Undertaker-Mabel match, which was the key program of this elimination match.
Seems like a rare instance where the babyface is basically clean house and win for nothing, all thanks to the Undertaker. And, you know, in this scenario, it makes sense.
And King Mo, or Sir Mo, took a choke slam. I mean, my sports mixed up. King Mo is the fighter. Sir Mo, the wrestler. Then we go to Doc Hendricks, who's plugging the new denim jacket that the WWF is offering. This hideous piece of shit features a WWF logo on the front of this denim jacket and a giant Undertaker, like, splash logo on the back.
It was actually a painting of the Undertaker.
Ugh. Then Doc Hendricks, he decides to personalize the ad.
Yeah.
He was doing some shopping at the mall over the weekend, and he saw all these denim jackets that don't have any logos on them, and they go for $50. This jacket with these beautiful paintings is only $59.75, and we also have Shawn Michaels and Diesel-themed denim jackets.
Oh, a painting. What a bonus.
And then, like when you see those crazy, like, you know, quick-fix health pill ads, you got to put the disclaimer on it. He just quickly notes that they do have a tendency to run a little small. What the fuck does that mean? They have a tendency to run a little small. And we don't sell these in arenas or on the catalog. You can only buy it by phoning this number right now and getting your $60 denim jacket. God damn, was this a merchandise plug.
Hey, guys, let me take you on some early Christmas shopping. Now, with the return of The Undertaker, if this isn't perfect, check out this denim jacket. The Undertaker insignia on the left. The WWF insignia on the right, and look at the back, baby. The Undertaker. You know, I was going through the mall yesterday checking out denim jackets. Had nothing on it. They wanted $50. But this jacket, only $59.75. And say you want something else as your fancy? How about the Heartbreak Kid Shawn Michaels? That's right. We have a Shawn Michaels jacket. How about one of the title combatants? Bret the Hitman Hart, and of course the current WWF champion, Big Daddy Cool Diesel. These jackets come in medium, they come in large, they come in extra large, and double XL. Now they do have a little tendency to run a little small. Keep that in mind, and get this, Vinnie Mac. This will never be sold in the venues. You can only get it tonight or on television. It's not on a catalog. You need to get it now. Once again, only $59.75. And, brother, I'm telling you, they are L-I-V-E live back to you.
All right, Doc, thank you very much. Bonnie Hall has nothing on you, pal.
I would love to see one today. If I saw one of these on the streets today, come on.
I would laugh at you.
I would actually offer $60 for one. A Diesel denim jacket?
I'll tell you. I wear a medium. I probably should have got a large. Runs a little small. They plug next month's In Your House, and they also set up the fact that the British Bulldog will get the winner of tonight's title match in the main event of that pay-per-view. I kind of like that idea where you have your main event already set up, and you have that scenario of the main event of who's going to face the Bulldog, having your contender set up, which I guess is kind of what they've got with Brock Lesnar. for January.
So I'm just looking up all the WWF denim jackets.
Oh, there were many, weren't
still
there?
Available. I mean, there are a number of Shawn Michaels denim jackets. Are these actually, are people actually selling this on eBay? eBay. Let's see how much these go for. Shawn Michaels Heartbreak Kid denim jacket. That one in particular is not for sale. But you can get, oh, Jesus, $200 for the Shawn Michaels jacket. There will be somebody who will buy it.
Is it from a M. Hayes Freebird Forever?
I don't know if he'd have it. But you can get yours still if you really wanted.
They air a promo from Bret Hart as he's reacting to the British Bulldog getting the winner. This was like right out of like an MMA interview where he says he's not looking past Diesel. It's like the most prototype answer you'll get from a fighter when you ask him about a hypothetical fight after the current one.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm not looking past this guy. And he talks about the fact that he feels like Wayne Gretzky, who has to ask himself if he is still the best. And today he's going to find that out, and reiterates, the truck stops here. And flat out says Diesel doesn't have the technical ability to beat him, which is true.
Was Gretzky like in the middle of retirement or something at the time? Like what?
No, but this was at the point where I believe he was still with, he would have still been with the Blues at this point before going to the Rangers. He was certainly on the decline of his career because he'd retire in 99.
But he was just
accurately.
Yeah. So he was still newsworthy for bouncing back and forth, maybe.
Yes. Then we go to a shirtless Diesel in the locker room. He agrees that the longer this match goes, the more it favors Bret. But he doesn't get paid by the hour. He is coming to do high-impact maneuvers and says the WWF has been running quite nicely on Diesel power. Their house show attendants would suggest otherwise, that they preferred regular or unleaded. Pettengill is then with Jim Cornette. Oh, we skipped the promo earlier where Cornette was with the other team, the Survivor Series wild card team, and now he was with the opposite team because this was a mismatch of heels and baby faces put onto two separate teams, with Cornette having Bulldog on one team and Owen on the other. So here is Cornette with the Bulldog, Sid, and Ted DiBiase. Todd brings up the fact that Cornette was with the opposing team earlier. DiBiase says he is not to cross him. And then Michaels walks in, uses the word wild as many times as he possibly can, and talks about how the chicks love to fight over him, and the men are going to have to go through Ahmed because Ahmed is his back door.
Oh.
I don't know. Maybe he was trying to be a little androgynous as well at the time.
Ahmed is my back door.
So this takes us to the wild card match. The story, if you can call it that at this point, was Shawn Michaels. They brought this up and turned this into a storyline, was the fact that the prior month, Shawn Michaels, the British Bulldog, and the 1-2-3 Kid, they had been out at a bar and were getting taken to their hotel room. And Michaels was apparently loaded at the time. And these 10 dudes came up and started just harassing them and then proceeded to beat the shit out of Shawn Michaels. And there was actually a police report filed, and Michaels is really fucked up from it. And it resulted in him not working the October pay-per-view and then coming back here on this show. And in a weird way, they took that and turned it into this concussion storyline and really kind of put Shawn over the top as their key guy going into WrestleMania and overcoming this. They shoot a huge angle the night after the Survivor Series with Owen Hart that is well-remembered and then has come back at the Royal Rumble. So in a weird way, this real, actual incident turned into this storyline where they babyfaced Shawn Michaels and kind of skirted around, you know, the story and made it a positive out of things. But they really did a number on Shawn Michaels, like slammed the car door on his head and it was pretty nuts.
Yeah, and but you could tell even from this point that, you know, Shawn was getting the rocket strapped to him. And you can especially tell because Vince.
Oh, I wrote that down. He found his new star.
The new star, ladies and gentlemen, the most brilliant, the most defiant WWF superstar in the world. People. Sit down, William McMahon.
he came out and the way he sold Shawn Michaels.
He was going nuts. Look at this man. Look at this sexy boy. He just was.
Imperfect. Sit down, McMahon.
Yeah, he was just.
It's just drooling crazy. Here. Vince buying into the androgynous aspect of the character.
Sure.
Razor Ramon was the current IC champion at this point. I love this. Sid came out and they cut to a fan, like a little kid with a camera, and JR says, "Save your camera. He's not worth the film." So we had Razor Ramon, Yokozuna, Owen Hart, and Dean Douglas.
Now who's heel, who's face?
We had Razor Ramon as the baby face on one side with Douglas, Owen, and Yoko as the heels.
Okay.
Taking on Shawn Michaels and Ahmed Johnson, who were your baby faces, Psycho Sid and British Bulldog, your heels. Mm. This sounds extremely confusing the way I'm laying it out.
Confusing, you know, when you're just picking one show out, you know, and watching it 16 years later.
Yeah.
Or whatever, 20 years later. But I thought it was an interesting concept at the time.
At the time, I remember when this happened, and I thought it was really cool, the fact that you would have heels and baby faces working together.
Yeah.
I think today I would really not like it. It doesn't feel like a novel idea today, and I think it's just more confusion than the reward. But this to me at the time was just really neat, because you never saw these guys have to work together, and just the idea Owen and Bulldog are these two guys attached at the hip who are now on opposite ends, I thought it was interesting. Mm-hmm. At the time, and we got a really solid match out of it too. JR compares the opposite teammates to Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich having to get into the same room and balance the federal budget. Fucking scraping the barrel here to really hit home this whole U.S. government issue. Yeah. With the Republicans and Democrats. Tons of wild references from the announcers here, really getting over the wild card match. Michaels and Owen started the match. We saw Michaels spank Jim Cornette with a tennis racket. Shane Douglas, Dean Douglas, was wearing this outfit. He wore a singlet and these boots with exclamation points on them to emphasize his scholarly attributes.
Why do exclamation points?
I guess that emphasized his intelligence. An exclamation point.
Okay.
Maybe a thought bubble would have been better as a logo.
Sure.
For Dean Douglas. We have Douglas miss a Vader bomb, and then Michaels hits a moonsault off the top. We have Ramon and Dean Douglas, who are feuding at the time, arguing on the floor. Ramon decks him, and then Michaels rolls up Dean Douglas for the first elimination. Just a total geek, this Dean Douglas. A low point of Shane Douglas's career, this WWF run. Bulldog and Owen are tagged in. Great sequence here, but a very short one as Bulldog tags out. And then Michaels and Ramon are tagged in, playing off of you know, their two ladder matches they had together. Michaels bends over and then gets lifted up as Razor hits the Razor's Edge, and Ahmed Johnson makes the save. And Ross notes, Ross was great in this match, where they played up Shawn Michaels taking all these maneuvers and his head bouncing off the mat and really kind of emphasizing this head trauma he's taking and foreshadowing the angle that they would shoot the next night on Raw with Owen. After that, we had a spot where Michaels and, was it Bulldog, ran into each other head first, and Michaels is disoriented. Ramon then gets beaten down by Sid. Sid climbs on top, gets tossed off, and then we have a choke slam delivered to Razor Ramon. Michaels gets tagged in, Ramon ducks, and then Sid gets hit with the Sweet Chin Music. Ramon goes for the cover, but then Bulldog runs in and misses Ramon with a leg drop, and instead leg drops Sid.
See,
this was really confusing.
I don't know.
It was a clear screw-up.
Yeah, ultimately it kind of worked out, but it really was weird. Like, I almost got the feeling Bulldog ran in for the save when he really shouldn't have.
And then hit the wrong guy.
Yeah. Yeah, it was very strange, and the announcers said just as much.
And then Razor pins Sid, who isn't even the legal man.
Really?
Yeah, because Bulldog was still the...
No.
Remember, Bulldog did the blind tag, and that's why he came in and hit the leg drop, and I think Sid had been tagged out at this point.
I don't know. I'm confused.
All right. This is sounding like a confusing match in hindsight. Before Sid leaves the ring, he powerbombs Michaels, so he was taking all these spots. Yokozuna comes in, throws Michaels around, is wearing him down. Owen Hart misses this top rope headbutt as Ahmed gets tagged in. Owen takes the Pearl River plunge, and Owen gets eliminated. Ahmed then hits a spinebuster to Razor Ramon, and then poses on the turnbuckle like an idiot. And Razor just pops up and hits the Razor's Edge to him. But then Sid and the 1-2-3 Kid and DiBiase come down to ringside. They trip up Razor, who turns around, gets hit by a running power slam, and Bulldog eliminates Ramon. So it's 3-on-1 now with Michaels, Ahmed Johnson, and the British Bulldog against Yokozuna. And Yoko hits a giant leg drop to Michaels, misses a bonsai drop to a huge reaction. Michaels staggers up, falls into the corner, tagging in Ahmed, who hits a scoop slam. Bulldog breaks the cover, so then Michaels and Ahmed take out their teammate, the Bulldog. Sweet Chin Music is hit to Yokozuna, followed by a giant splash by Ahmed, and they get the pinfall. This thing went 27 minutes, 25 seconds. We noted the screw-up in the middle, but overall, I thought this was a pretty strong match. In particular, Shawn Michaels, who was the key focus of the entire match.
Yeah, I thought so. I think the concept is interesting in theory, and I think it could have offered maybe some more interesting little scenarios featuring babyface versus babyface or heel versus heel, but ultimately perhaps a little bit confusing. But I give him credit for trying something different. I was, you know, knowing that Bulldog was going to get a title shot the next match, I thought his positioning in this match was a little underwhelming. He came out of this kind of looking just sort of like a coward who latched onto the babyface's victory.
Right. We go back to Bill Clinton, who has Sonny on his lap.
Mr. President, obviously you're enjoying yourself, sir.
Yes, I am, Dodd. You know, there's nothing that I enjoy more than sitting back, enjoying some popcorn, and watching a perfect match. Hey, would you like some popcorn here? Oh. Excuse me, I'm sorry. Yeah, you know, you're pretty good at this. You think you might be available for a cabinet position?
Oh, Mr. President, I'd love to.
Why don't you stop by the White House? Maybe we'll go over some of those positions.
Oh, Mr. President, I think I'd make the perfect undersecretary.
Oh, I think you would too. Yes.
Maybe.
Vince, let's go back to you.
Thank you very much.
And Todd interviews him again. He's staring at Sonny's boobs, stating how he loves watching a perfect match, and then drops popcorn all over her, offers her a cabinet position, and asks her to come by the White House to go over those positions. This was only amusing because this was years before the Bill Clinton scandals. Mm-hmm. So they were well ahead of the curve here.
Yeah, they predicted it. I thought Sonny was great. You know, she's great at just playing this flirtatious, I guess, whatever.
Fitch,
yes. But she's just always been very charismatic, and I recognize
very
that.
Much so.
I recognize that, you know, not every of the talents that they've had could pull this off.
Then we got a preview of the main event, playing off the Bret Hart Diesel matches from the King of the Ring 94 and Royal Rumble 95 matches. This is where Bret compares himself to a Timex watch.
What does
takes
he say?
A licking and keeps on ticking.
Oh,
and yes, Bret explained it verbatim for us. He says he has better cardio, and Diesel is not going to win on points like a collegiate wrestling match. This one isn't going to the judges. He's not going to do any lay and pray in this
He's
match.
He's just like looking for metaphors from every...
A lot of
every
people are down on Bret's promos at this time, but I enjoyed him as just like the no-nonsense like athlete.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this guy... You know, witty lines and big catchphrases didn't really suit the Bret Hart character. So I did not mind this. I think at the time, I didn't really look at Bret Hart as a great promo. In hindsight, I think he's much better.
I thought he was more than suitable and obviously very believable. As
it fit who Bret was.
As a guy who just took his wrestling extremely
exactly.
seriously.
Yes.
And as a guy who you knew would beat other people.
So then we go into... Bret Hart in a WWF title match at the Survivor Series with Vince McMahon at ringside and Earl Hebner officiating.
No DQ.
And a no DQ match.
Yeah.
Hebner shows Bret the title, and Bret just looks at the title and then looks at the crowd and pops up his eyebrows. It was the goofiest look. This would be a much better remembered Survivor Series for Bret. So they really established this no DQ step, which I didn't even realize it was until the match began, with Diesel and Bret each taking off a turnbuckle pad.
Mm-hmm.
And Hennig notes that this is the championship that has eluded him his entire career, and it's hard for him to watch this.
Okay, weird time to interject yourself into the match, but okay.
He was also very high on just the putting himself over and using the perfect analogy for everything. Mm-hmm. It was a little much, I thought.
Yeah, right.
Diesel overpowers Brett at the start. Brett's thrown into the steps. He's run into the post back first, even uses a chair on Brett. And they bring up the fact that it was Brett who used the chair illegally on Diesel at their Royal Rumble match. I liked how they weaved in these past matches into this current one.
Right.
And this is going back a year and a half.
This was also interesting because, like, Brett would, you know, as a babyface, he wasn't strictly a babyface who wouldn't take shortcuts, like using a chair.
I thought this was just such a well laid out, like, no DQ match where they made the stipulation really meaningful here. And that, like, just having the exposed turnbuckles and always having those two in play during the match and all these little things they did where Brett pretty much, like, worked at times as a full out heel, just doing all these dirty tactics, but it's all with.
But it made sense because he was just being strategic. You know, and I think obviously without the no DQ, you would have had to rely a lot more on just the wrestling ability of Kevin Nash, which was not a match that he'll really excel at.
Diesel goes for a powerbomb, and Bret Hart hooks onto his leg to block it, and then Hart bites Diesel's arm to get out of it, and Hart gets onto his back, rakes the eye of Diesel, just dirty, and then starts stomping on the left knee. Applies a figure four and just starts working the left leg. The sharpshooter gets stopped with a poke to the eyes of Brett and then gets kicked into the corner into the exposed buckle. And Hart then grabs this microphone cable and ties up Diesel's leg into the corner as he attacks the knee with the chair. And Diesel would remain tied up for a number of minutes here until he finally untied himself.
Yeah.
But this, again, just with Brett working here into this no DQ stipulation.
Yeah, watching this now, it seems a little too implausible and goofy. This man just took a rope and tied another man into the corner and he couldn't get up. He couldn't untie himself.
Well, he's got very bad knees, Way.
I suppose.
He can't just pop up.
But, you know, watching as a kid, it was totally believable. And I think if you're going to get anybody to do it, you probably assume Brett would be able to make it the most believable.
When I say great sellers, Kevin Nash doesn't immediately pop into my mind, but I thought he sold his knee tremendously.
I agree.
Throughout this match.
Yeah.
It really added a lot. I mean, this working of the knee played into the entire match. Hart clotheslines him to the floor, misses this like twisting pescado that Diesel just sidesteps his way out of, and bringing up that this is a patented spot Hart does, and Diesel's been studying him. And then the big spot of the show, which this was extremely novel at the time. In fact, this might be the first time I recall the Spanish announce table being used in a WWF match. I might be incorrect on that.
No way. Come on, really?
In 95, they didn't. I mean, this wasn't a standard spot at all.
Okay.
And Brett is on the apron, and Diesel just flings him off through the wooden announce desk.
With all the stuff on it.
Yeah.
All the monitors, all the.
The announcers are just all chaotic here in reaction to this, and the crowd went nuts for this as he went through this table, and Hart gets sent back into the ring. He's playing dead. Diesel calls for the jackknife powerbomb, receives a lot of boos, and Hart just plops right back down as he tries to lift him. Diesel leans over to lift him, and Hart grabs him with a small package and gets the pinfall out of nowhere at 24:53. It was kind of like just stealing the win out of nowhere, and Diesel is just livid after this match that he got caught, powerbombs Brett twice, knocks off all these officials, and this was pretty much Diesel's heel turn for his final number of months with the company, and poses with the title, drops it down on Brett. Vince is condemning him for this poor sportsmanship, and they go off the air with this highlight video of the entire event. But what did you think of the match overall, Way?
Well, I mean, first let me say, my opinion of this match is going to be very much, you know, kind of blinded because I vividly remember my reaction to seeing this match. I was a big Bret Hart fan, but even as a kid, you know, not knowing all the ins and outs about pro wrestling, you could still kind of tell who would win and who wouldn't win based on who they're focusing on. And I remember, you know, at this time, you know, Bret was a babyface, but he wasn't really getting that much attention. in the storylines. You know, he wasn't, it wasn't as obvious as, say, you know, Shawn Michaels heading into WrestleMania 12. So going into the match, I thought it would just be another title defense for Diesel, you know, who had held the title for a year up to this point. And so when Brett just kind of won out of nowhere, it was like one of my most genuine markout moments. You know what I mean? So I love this match a lot simply for that reason. But just watching it from as an adult, just from a technical standpoint, I really enjoyed it too. It told a very basic, simple story. Brett working on the legs, you know, both men kind of having the advantage at certain times using weapons, and then the finish coming out of nowhere. It was very believable, and, you know, obviously one of the best Kevin Nash matches that I'd seen. One of the best Brett matches I've seen, too. I could put it up there.
So that ended Diesel's 1 year title reign at the time, and they came back actually after this highlight video with just Vince, Jim Ross, and Mr. Perfect reacting to the main event. Brett is still being tended to in the ring. Ross calls it heartbreaking. And Perfect says it was not a perfect day for Bret Hart or Diesel, but Vince calls it a perfect Survivor Series. And that ends the show. I thought a very enjoyable Survivor Series show, one that I went in. You know, this was a real fun show to watch. I give this show a 8.5 out of 10. I really enjoyed it. I think the outside of the Bam Bam Bigelow Goldust match, everything kind of served the purpose. Even the Taker match, it was just kind of a showcase for him to run through guys for his return. And great opener. You had a great wild card match, a great main event. Very enjoyable Survivor Series.
Yeah, I mean, I liked the show a lot too. It wasn't, never felt like a drag to really watch. Maybe the Bam Bam Goldust match was.
Yeah, but even that, I mean, 8 minutes, I can take one. You know, kind of dull match.
You know, and you think about it, like, I thought all the Survivor Series matches had some storyline. It had a number of storyline threads to tell, a number of matches that they were building onto. And I think that's really what's great about the Survivor Series match that I think they've really kind of lost track of over recent years. They're not just really about, you know, multi-man matches, putting people together. Like, they're kind of used to, you know, preview and build story matches that you have coming up, and they did a great job of booking these matches back then, but for whatever reason in recent years the concept has just kind of been lost. So I give the show 8.5 as well.
Yeah, you really got the sense that they knew where their booking was going, and this was really designed to just push these stories forward. You weren't necessarily getting massive conclusions to any of these other than a big title change that ended a long reign. But you knew what the main event was of the next pay-per-view. You knew Undertaker Mabel was going in that direction. You knew Shawn Michaels was clearly positioned as the eventual successor, as the company's top babyface. And Brett was really in a transition role at this point to get that title ready for Michaels at WrestleMania. But you clearly saw where all the key programs were going at this point. So let's go over to the message board. We will start off with Matt in suburban Detroit. So disappointed that this is the Survivor Series being reviewed. If you do another, I want to hear Way's reaction to 1990. Vince McMahon on commentary. It's a drinking game. So it's drinking game time. The show was not very good. The wild card match features 5 heels and 3 faces. Why would Gorilla Monsoon allow that to happen? The big plus was how every Bret Hart match felt like a big deal in a bad era. Scott Putski Award needs to go to Barry Horowitz. It's probably the only event you'll review where he's on and on a win streak. 2 out of 10. I would say Ahmed really stood out in the Putski department.
Me too. Dwayne from Ireland. Bizarrely, I enjoyed this show. Despite the opener essentially being a who's who of 90s mid-card jobbers, there were a few talented workers involved, and it was a surprisingly good match. That said, the Barry chant for Horowitz said it all for the star power in that match. Did Goldust have a boner throughout his match with Bam Bam? The thing was just poking out of his gear the entire time. Very off-putting. The main event undoubtedly stole the show. It was given a big fight build up during the show with both men talking about their strategies, and both JR and Perfect were excellent on commentary for the match too. For my money, the best match of Kevin Nash's career. Am I right in thinking this was the first announced table spot in the WWE?
To the best of my recollection, it's the first one I can recall. But I am sure if I'm wrong, I will be made aware of it. We continue on. Next is Ronaldo from Italy. Glad you guys are reviewing this, and this is not only the pay-per-view that gave life to one of the very first work shoot promos the day after on Raw with Diesel denouncing the WWF, but also the pay-per-view debut of one Ahmed Johnson, with many botched spots and stiff matches to follow on upcoming shows. I remember being 15 and going, no way Brett's going to win this belt, yet he won out of the blue, and I couldn't believe it, as Brett was my favorite wrestler back in the day. The wild card match was a cool concept and something innovative, but there was no segue to it, in my opinion. People can count the Click members one by one, but did you know that most of the wrestlers in the Dark Side match were part of Taker's backstage Click, BSK? Nice show. Lots of memories about staying awake at night to watch shows due to the time difference between the US and Europe, and not caring one bit because I was such a big fan. I think this was also the year that the Major League Baseball introduced the wild card to the playoff system, and they had just finished. So maybe that was the play off of the word
wild card. Gotcha. We go to Chris Anato, who says, gentlemen, another review from the solid gold mid-90s. I need to echo Dwayne's critique of Goldust's pubic protuberance. Although I doubt that's a boner, I guess we can presume that Goldust didn't wear some tights underneath his onesie for this show. This happened more than one occasion, as I remember being weirded out as a boy when Goldust would do this. But at the time, I chalked it up to Goldust being bizarre. I really liked the wild card match, if only because it was different. You can always count on Sean and Scott Hall trying to at least be interesting and entertaining. And of course, the main event, which might be Kevin Nash's best match. It's either this or the pay-per-view match before heading back to WCW involving Shawn Michaels. I think this match also marks the first time in WWF history that we saw a wrestler angrily mouth some very bad words, as Diesel did falling for Brett's tricks. P.S. A song request. This number one song. Maybe we'll get to it.
Wade decides the song. Tommy from Hollywood here. We'll skim through this. This might be the worst offering I've ever seen in WWE, and I expect it to get absolutely panned. Well, you expected wrong. The booking decisions completely ignored momentum, and the card had no clear heel-face dynamic. The good. The opener had some high points. Hakushi's high spots and crisp ring work with the underdogs. Sunny as a mouthpiece and her interference spot with Marty. The women's Survivor Series match was the highlight of the show. All right, let's get into what he didn't like. The bad. Literally every promo was below average, with Brett bordering on cringeworthy. The finish of Goldust Bigelow, with Goldust cutting short Bigelow's running wild with a single running bulldog and pinning him. The tasteless Bill Clinton statement and poor old Bob Backlund. The wild card match with no clear heel face balance and constant teasing and three occurrences of full-out dissension. Bulldog and Owen Hart having only a few spots on the show despite having held undercard titles in the Federation. The ugly. Bertha Faye's character and inability to wrestle, Mr. Perfect's commentary or lack thereof, and his sexism. Bret Hart, the super face, raking eyes, hitting chair shots, and tying up Diesel's foot with a ring rope. The Undertaker in the ring under 3 minutes, and his merry band of worthless jobber partners working most of the match. Everything about Mabel and his referee imposter partner. A face winning the world title with a roll-up at a point where he had zero momentum, constant brawling outside, and rest spots in a Bret Hart match. 3 out of 10. I don't think he liked this show.
No, wow. Andrew McDonald says, 1995 gets panned, and for the most part, rightfully so. But I feel that the WWE certainly had a pretty good talent roster at the time, but they were poorly misused. Two people who stood out on the show for me were Rad Radford and Isaac Yankum with their in-ring ability. When you look up and down the roster, too, there are some pretty talented performers like Dr. Tom, Chris Candido, Shane Douglas, Owen Hart, and the list goes on. But having an evil dentist and a grunge rocker as part of your roster is one of the many reasons 1995 was the worst year financially WWE has ever had. Match of the night for me was the wild card match, not just for nostalgia purposes, but I really enjoyed the concept of heels and babyfaces teaming due to a supposedly random draw. I like how Jim Cornette pretty much had to talk out of both sides of his mouth during his two promos putting all the guys over, and how Razor Ramon joined in on the corner beating of Ahmed Johnson, showing he still had a bit of a mean streak and would still do anything to win despite not being in friendly company. The main event was good as well, but I feel that Brett probably should have been champion in all of 95. Maybe that could have helped their fortunes. 7 out of 10.
Their worst financial year is going to be this year. They're going to lose more money this year than any year ever.
Man.
Because of the network. All right. I really enjoyed the Survivor Series. This was a fun show to go back and check out from Way's childhood, sandwiched between Beauty and the Beast and Booty and the Beast on his nice dial. But the Survivor Series. Now, next week, What did we agree on? I'm blanking.
We
decided right before the show what we were going to review.
Oh, shit. We were going to watch...
TNA.
Yes.
It's, the final new episode of Impact on Spike this week. As of right now, we don't know when Impact will be back, but we are going to take a look back at a show which I will say was, if you want to call TNA and look at high points, the fall of 2006 really felt like a time period where there was that kind of momentum. There was good and bad at that time, as TNA typically always had. But we are going to go and review the TNA Genesis pay-per-view from November of 2006. And what was important about this, because a lot of people don't remember what stuff happened in TNA history, but on that show, it was the very first Kurt Angle Samoa Joe match, and it was the first time they did a real number on pay-per-view. So we're going to go back, look at that first Angle Joe match when Angle had first come into the company. He served as a guest referee the month prior at Bound for Glory, and this match, I remember you at the time were so stoked for that particular match. I think it was the peak of your TNA interest.
No,
was that pay-per-view.
Okay, cool. I don't remember it, but yeah.
So that is next week, TNA Genesis 2006. Do you have a song that you want to go out with, Ware? Are you going to take the request, or are you going to go rogue on us?
No, I actually like, Hacksaw Jim Powers' request. Mr. Fact Checker himself. He would like to request the number one song at the time of Survivor Series 1995, and that is Mariah Carey's Fantasy.
All right, as we get set for next week's fantasy matchup between Kurt Angle and Samoa Joe, which it was at the time in 2006.
Oh, great.
We go out with Mariah Carey and Old Dirty Bastard.
Yes.
Perfect song to finish off this show. In the meantime, go check out liveaudiowrestling.com for all of our shows in the podcast section. Follow Way on Twitter and Instagram, Way0937, at I am John Pollock, and we'll chat with you all later on this week. Enjoy.
All right, JR, continue with the call.
Asagawa now. Gonna try to put Aja Kong away, but that's no easy feat, I'll tell you. As Aja got up and caught her with that martial arts kick to the abdomen. This young lady may get an education right here against Aja Kong.
As in King Kong, right?
Believe it or not, she's a national spokesperson for orange juice.
Body all you need to have. Baby, baby, come on. Baby, come on. Baby, come on.